60-year anniversary of the assassination of JFK, interview with key witness Ruth Payne. Commentary. It was 60 years ago on November 22, 1963, that President John F. Kennedy was assassinated while riding in a motorcade in the streets of Dallas with his wife, Jackie. There is a key witness in the investigation of Lee Harvey Oswald, the alleged assassin of JFK, whom I discovered is living right in Santa Rosa, California, where I live. In fact, in the same part of town. Her name is Ruth Payne. She is now age 91 and living in the Friends House, a lovely facility for elderly people, sponsored by the Quakers. I called their number and was connected to Ruth. She graciously accepted an appointment for an interview and allowed me to take a picture of her. This was done a year ago, November 2022. The picture shows her seated on her small porch in front of the window of her apartment, showing the slogans that she, as a Quaker and a peace activist, has stood for most of her life: war is not the answer, and love thy neighbor. She felt so strongly that our nation should not be involved in war that she refused to give her entire yearly taxes to the IRS and would deduct what she thought was the amount that our government was using for war. She would always write a letter to the IRS explaining why she was not paying the full amount and would even copy her congressman. Sometimes she would get a nice letter back from her congressman saying that they agreed with her. What response did she get from the IRS? They would just levy her bank accounts and take out the tax money she owed. Ruth's involvement with Oswald and his wife. In 1962, Ruth was separated from her husband, Michael, and was living in Dallas with her two children when she met Lee Harvey Oswald and his wife at a party. Marina was from Russia, where Lee had met her. Ruth was studying Russian, so that helped them have a connection. The Oswalds had been living in Fort Worth with Lee's mother and were moving to Dallas, and they needed a place to stay, but they were also separated and needed separate places to live. Ruth said that Marina and their two small daughters, June and Rachel, could stay with her. In exchange, Marina could give her Russian tutoring lessons. The reason the Oswalds were separated was probably because Lee had a terrible temper and was often abusive and would hit Marina. Lee lost his job, and Marina suggested that he go back to New Orleans where his relatives were and maybe they could help him. He did find a job in New Orleans, and Ruth was kind enough to drive Marina and her children to join him there. Lee was working for the Louisiana Coffee Company, but didn't like it and only worked there from May until August. In September, Ruth drove to New Orleans and helped them move back to Dallas. Lee then made a surprise bus trip to Mexico City to visit the Cuban and Russian embassy, wanting to move to Cuba, but he was denied. When he returned, Ruth, through a friend, was able to get Lee a job working at the Texas School Book Depository, the seven-story warehouse that supplied the schools in both Texas and Oklahoma with the textbooks they needed. Oswald stayed in a boarding house and would come every weekend to see his family if he could get a ride. He never owned a car. Oswald's childhood. Ruth Payne told me that she was always worried about Oswald. He did not seem like a very stable person. She found out that he had had a rough childhood growing up without a father and with a very difficult mother. His father had died of a heart attack 2 months before he was born. His mother, Marguerite, was not very loving. She remarried for only 3 years, and she was then single again, and had a hard time supporting her family of three children, Lee, his older brother Robert, and his half-brother John. According to an interview with Oswald's brother Robert by Frontline magazine on November 13, 2013, Marguerite and her three children moved frequently 20 times before Oswald was age 17. Sometimes the children were put in an orphanage and Lee was put in a boarding school. Marguerite made sure they all knew what a burden they were on her. The older brothers both left home early and served in the Marines. With all the moves and his unstable life, Lee had a real struggle in school and was a loner. He would just sit by himself and read. One of the places that he and his mother lived was New York City. He spent much time in the public library there reading. That could be where he began to learn about Marxism. When his mother moved him to Fort Worth, Texas, he quit high school early and followed the example of his older brothers, joining the Marines in 1956 at the age of 17. Oswald's time in the Marines. An article from PBS Frontline on November 19, 2013, states that Oswald spent only 3 years in the Marines, for the most part stationed in Japan. He learned to be a sharpshooter, the one thing he enjoyed. The rest was a real struggle for him. He was not used to so much discipline and complained a lot. He would say that it was the capitalist form of government that made the soldiers have to do all the hard, rigorous training they were doing. Under communism, that would not happen. He spoke so much about his affinity to socialism/communism that his fellow Marines nicknamed him Oswaldskovich. Illusions of grandeur. In an article about Oswald in PsychologyToday.com in November 2013, a psychologist, Stephen A. Diamond, gave an analysis of Oswald as a typical loner, coming from a sad childhood and seeking illusions of grandeur, wanting to do something that would make him stand out and feel important. Oswald defected to the Soviet Union. In 1959, after Oswald said he was allowed to voluntarily leave the service, he was disillusioned with his life in the United States and decided to defect to the Soviet Union. He traveled to Finland and went by train to Moscow, where he sought to become a citizen. In his letter applying for Soviet citizenship, he wrote, "I want citizenship because I am a communist and a worker. I have lived in a decadent capitalist society, where the workers are slaves." He fantasized he would be welcomed as a hero with open arms. But instead, the Soviet officials promptly rejected him, telling the stunned American to go home. Oswald was so discouraged and despondent that he tried to commit suicide. He wrote in what he called his historic diary the following, "I am shocked. My fond dreams are shattered. I decided to end it. Soak rice in cold water to numb the pain, then slash my left wrist." Shortly after this journal entry, he did slash his wrist and was found unconscious in the bathtub. He was rushed to a local hospital in Moscow, where he remained for a week. The Soviet officials then decided to let him stay, under extremely close scrutiny. The KGB had intensive spying on him the entire time he was in the Soviet Union. According to https://fee.org/articles, a 2013 book was written about Oswald's time in the Soviet Union by Peter Savodnik, titled The Interloper: Lee Harvey Oswald Inside the Soviet Union. The book tells how Oswald was moved to Minsk, where he began working for the Minsk Radio Factory, manufacturing radios. He also became involved with a group of students. They wanted him to teach them English, especially to speak with a southern accent as Oswald did. Oswald stayed for 3 years, working and marrying a young Russian woman, Marina. However, feeling bored and disappointed with the reality of life in the Soviet Union, in 1962, Oswald returned to the United States, taking Marina with him along with their three-month-old daughter, June. They ended up back in Fort Worth, living with his mother. Oswald's first attempt at killing. Ruth told me that most people are not aware that 7 months before the killing of JFK, on April 10, Oswald had attempted to kill another man with the same powerful military rifle that he used on JFK. Ruth discovered that Oswald had it stored in her own garage, hidden inside a rolled-up blanket. The man Oswald tried to kill was retired Major General Edwin A. Walker, a leader in the John Birch Society. Oswald told Marina that the JBS was a fascist organization. The truth is that the JBS was one of the foremost groups speaking out against communism from its founding in 1958. Oswald did not like groups that spoke out against communism. Background on Major General Walker. In doing more research on Walker, I found out that he served in both World War II and the Korean War. In 1955, on assignment in Korea, he became aware of the communist Chinese brainwashing tactics that were being used on our U.S. military. In October 1959, Walker was appointed commander of the 24th Infantry Division in Europe, stationed in Augsburg, Germany. Pro-Blue Program. Walker decided to start a program to counter the propaganda and brainwashing tactics of the communists. He called it Pro-Blue, a program for teaching his troops about the true history of our nation to make them proud to be American, and have them become true blue loyal Americans so they could not be so easily brainwashed. However, he also encouraged his troops to vote for Barry Goldwater in the presidential election. Of course, that did not go over well with President John F. Kennedy or Vice President Lyndon B. Johnson. They also were upset with Walker for calling Eleanor Roosevelt and Harry S. Truman Pinkos in print. In 1961, Walker was called home and relieved of his command. Walker then resigned from the Army, even turning down his pension. He moved to Dallas, where more conservatives lived. In early 1962, Walker ran for governor of Texas, but came in last of six candidates. Later that year, he was arrested for leading riots at Ole Miss in protest against federal troops being used to admit a black student, James Meredith, into the then all-white college. Walker wasn't against integration. He was against the federal troops being used. He believed they should have used the state National Guard. He had been assigned to bring in federal troops under Eisenhower in the Little Rock integration of schools, and he didn't like it then either. Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy had Walker arrested for his protesting and had him committed to an insane asylum for a 90-day evaluation. But many people, even psychiatrists and the ACLU, protested Walker being there. Walker was released after 5 days. When he came back to Dallas, there was a huge crowd of people at the airport to welcome him. In the beginning of 1963, Walker had been traveling around Texas on a 6-week speaking tour with Billy James Hargis, head of the Christian Crusade. They were warning people about communism and how it had infiltrated high up in our government and among Hollywood movie stars, school teachers, and university professors. Walker was back home in Dallas, seated at his desk and working on his taxes on April 10, when a gunshot was heard. A bullet went through the window and right over his scalp, parting his hair and causing bleeding. Neighbors had seen someone who looked like Oswald prowling around Walker's property and taking pictures days before the shooting. The same high-powered military rifle that was used in the shooting of JFK was used in the attempted Walker shooting, and Marina told what Lee had told her about the attempted killing in her testimony before the Warren Commission. There was also a hidden note from Lee to Marina. The hidden note. Ruth Payne had made copies of the note and allowed me to take one. It was originally written in Russian and showed a list of what Oswald had provided for Marina in case he was arrested or killed, things like the mailbox that he had opened at the post office and paid for, where his checks from work would be sent. A message to her that he had paid for the rent, the water, and the gas. And instructions on where his papers were in a small blue suitcase. He left her as much money as he could, $60 and $10 a week. The last item stated, "If I am alive and taken prisoner, the city jail is at the end of the bridge we always used to cross when we went to town." This shows that Oswald was planning on doing something so bad that it would cause his arrest and even death, and if he were alive, he wanted Marina to come and visit him. Why did Oswald try to kill Walker? When I asked Ruth Payne if she believed Oswald was a communist and someone high up in the Communist Party was telling him whom to kill, she said no. She believes that he was just emotionally and mentally disturbed and that he acted alone on both shootings. She believes that he had targeted Walker because he was so prominent in Texas at the time and Oswald wanted to make a name for himself. But he immediately fled the scene, so he did not make a name for himself. No one knew about it until later. Many others believed Oswald was a communist or a communist sympathizer. His fellow Marines said that Oswald was often making pro-Russian, pro-Cuban, and anti-American radical remarks. According to the testimony of his wife Marina, before the Warren Commission, Oswald wanted to kill Walker because he felt Walker was a bad man, the leader of a fascist organization, and Lee was very sorry that he had not hit him. In the Warren Commission hearings in which Marina was asked to testify, she said that some communist leader had written a letter to Lee, and Lee was very happy after receiving it. Assassination of JFK. As mentioned, Ruth said that the large rifle that Oswald had used, unknown to her, had been stored in her garage, placed inside a rolled-up blanket. Oswald always came to visit Marina on the weekend, but this time he came on a Thursday and spent the night. He must have gotten the gun then. The next day was November 22. Oswald was picked up and taken to work at the TSBD by Buell Frazier, a friend and fellow worker, who later testified that he believed Oswald was innocent. Frazier said that Oswald had the gun wrapped in brown paper, and he assumed it was the curtain rods that Oswald had talked about getting for the sixth floor window where he worked. President Kennedy and his wife, Jackie, were in the back seat of a convertible in the motorcade driving through the streets of Dallas. The motorcade was scheduled to be at Dealey Plaza and driving past the Texas School Book Depository at 12:30. The rifle was in place at the window, ready for them. Some witnesses said they saw a man standing at the window. Three shots rang out. Not only was JFK fatally shot, but Governor Connally was shot as well. He had injuries to his chest, hand, and thigh. Both men were rushed to the hospital. JFK was pronounced dead half an hour later, but Connally was able to survive. The killing of Officer J.D. Tippetts and Oswald's capture. Oswald left his rifle on the sixth floor and immediately fled the building. He caught a bus a few blocks away and then a taxi back to his room at the boarding house where he was staying at 1026 North Beckley Avenue in the Oak Cliff section of Dallas. He got his revolver and a coat to cover it with and started walking aimlessly. For some reason, he ended up about a mile away at his old high school, W.H. Adamson High, from which he had dropped out in the 10th grade to join the Marines. He was stopped for questioning by a police officer named J.D. Tippetts, who was driving by. All the streets were closed off, and people everywhere were being questioned. Oswald resented being questioned. Angry words were expressed, and as Tippetts got out of his car, Oswald shot him with the gun he had hidden under his coat. Oswald then fled into a busy shopping area close by. He discarded his coat and began darting in and out of storefronts, hiding from police cars he heard driving by with their sirens wailing. Johnny Calvin Brewer, the manager of a shoe store, noticed Oswald's suspicious behavior and began following him for several blocks. He saw Oswald duck into a vintage movie theater called the Texas Theater, once owned by Howard Hughes. Oswald slipped by a distracted ticket taker, who was listening to the radio, and disappeared into the darkness. Brewer hailed a police officer, Nick McDonald, who entered the theater accompanied by another officer. The movie that was playing was War is Hell, starring Audie Murphy. It was a fitting movie title for the capture of Oswald, whose whole life had been a kind of war against himself and the world. Soon enough, the movie was stopped, and the lights came up. As McDonald came up the aisle, the manager of the theater pointed out Oswald as the one who had just come in. When the officers approached him, Oswald stood up and shouted, "This is it," and pulled out his revolver. But McDonald leapt on him, getting his finger between the pistol's hammer and the bullet, and the gun did not go off. A scuffle ensued. Oswald punched one of the officers and the officer punched him back, giving Oswald a black eye and a cut. They handcuffed him and took him to the Dallas jail. At least a dozen people witnessed Oswald's killing of Officer J.D. Tippetts and easily identified him at police headquarters. It wasn't until a few hours later that he was accused of also killing JFK. Oswald denied having killed anyone. In fact, he called himself a patsy, meaning someone else had done the killing and had given him the rap for it. Death of Oswald. We were never able to find out more, since Oswald did not live long enough to come to trial. 2 days after the JFK assassination, On November 24, a crowd of police and press were gathered in the basement of the Dallas Police Headquarters with television cameras filming as Oswald was being transferred from the local jail to a more secure facility. Suddenly, from the midst of the crowd, a man emerged, armed also with a .38 revolver, and shot Oswald point-blank. The man was Jack Ruby, the owner of a local nightclub and strip joint. He claimed that his rage at Oswald over the death of Kennedy was the motive for the killing, and he didn't want Kennedy's wife, Jackie, to have to endure the emotional trauma of the trial of Oswald. But some believe that Ruby was part of the cabal that had ordered the death of Kennedy and was following orders to kill Oswald so he would not be able to talk. There was something hanging over Ruby's head that made him have to do this. He was, of course, sentenced to die for manslaughter. While awaiting a new trial away from Dallas, Ruby died of lung cancer in 1967. The official Warren Commission report. Ruth Payne was one of the witnesses before the Warren Commission. She testified that Oswald acted alone, both in the attempted killing of Major General Walker and in the assassination of JFK. Many other witnesses testified the same. The Warren Commission concluded that neither Oswald nor Ruby were part of a larger conspiracy, either domestic or international, to assassinate President Kennedy. An updated Warren Commission report of November 21, 2022, reiterates the following. The Warren Commission took testimony from more than 550 witnesses and received more than 3,100 reports from the FBI and Secret Service. Aided by 10 departments of the federal government, 14 independent agencies, and 4 congressional committees, the Commission's 888-page final report concludes that shots fired by Lee Harvey Oswald from the Texas School Book Depository killed President Kennedy and wounded Texas Governor John Connally. The Commission found no evidence of a conspiracy. Following the presentation of the report to President Johnson on September 24, 1964, 26 volumes of hearings and evidence were released on November 23, 1964. Why are the files still secret? If the Warren Commission's conclusions are final, why are so many key JFK files still being kept secret? In 2017, President Trump was the only U.S. president to finally release some of the files, 2,800 of them, but kept back 300 files as still classified. In 2018, the Mary Farrell Foundation's analysis of the National Archives database reported some 21,890 JFK files that still remain wholly or partially secret. Approximately 85% of the secret files are held by the CIA and FBI. Conspiracy theories abound. Of course, with so much secrecy, conspiracy theories still surround the event. Even the 1978 House Select Committee on Assassinations concluded in a preliminary report that JFK was probably assassinated as a result of a conspiracy that may have involved multiple shooters and organized crime. The committee's findings, as with those of the Warren Commission, continue to be disputed by some. Statement by Frazier. Oswald's fellow worker Buell Frazier used to drive Oswald to work at the TSBD and back. He does not believe Oswald is guilty of the killing. He even saw the long gun wrapped in brown paper that Oswald put in the back seat of his car. He thought it was the curtain rods that Oswald had mentioned he was going to get to cover the window in his work area. In an interview with the Daily Mail on November 20, 2015, Frazier testified that he did not believe that the quiet, gentle young man Lee Oswald was capable of the shootings. He is sure that it was members of a cabal that were putting the blame on him, while the real killers were those who fired shots from the grassy knoll. It was those bullets that hit Kennedy from behind and killed him. Other workers testified that they actually saw Oswald down on the first floor of the TSBD, getting a drink and something to eat around 12:30 when the motorcade was passing by. Some people believe that there was a lookalike person for Oswald who was upstairs standing behind the gun. Some say that Oswald was ordered by his handlers to leave the TSBD as soon as possible and take a bus and a taxi to where he eventually was to go into the theater, where he would be met by someone from the mafia and be safe. Some believe that Oswald actually was to be killed by a member of the mafia so he could not talk. When those plans went awry due to the police arresting him and taking him to jail, Jack Ruby was ordered to kill him 2 days later. Statement by Carey. There was also a statement by John Carey, who is a second cousin to Michael Payne, Ruth's husband. According to the Daily Mail, when Mr. Carey was serving as Secretary of State to President Obama, he was interviewed by Tom Brokaw, November 11, 2013. When asked about the JFK assassination, he said, "To this day, I have serious doubts that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone." Mr. Brokaw replied, "Really?" Mr. Carey expounded, "I certainly have doubts that he was motivated by himself. I mean, I'm not sure if anybody else is involved. I won't go down that road with respect to the grassy knoll theory and all that, but I have serious questions about whether they got to the bottom of Lee Harvey Oswald's time and influence from Cuba and Russia." So in other words, Mr. Carey believes Oswald was influenced by Cuba and Russia, perhaps receiving marching orders from them about killing Kennedy. Motives and other questions. Why would Oswald want to kill JFK, one of the most beloved presidents? Ruth Payne believes that Oswald was just trying to make a name for himself, the same reason that he was trying to kill Walker. He had failed at so many things that he had tried to do in life, and he wanted to be recognized as doing something spectacular, even if it was something so evil. However, if that is the case, then why did Oswald continue to deny that he did it and say that he was just a patsy? The Warren Commission's conclusions that all three bullets fired were from the same person and from the same window with such accuracy does not hold water for two main reasons. One, the bullet holes in President Kennedy's suit jacket and shirt that corresponded to his neck wound were too low to have come from the sixth floor of the TSBD building. Documentation from both the autopsy and the death certificate state this. Two, several of the witnesses to the assassination stated that another bullet hit Governor John Connally after Kennedy had already been shot, disproving the single bullet theory's assertion that the same bullet hit Kennedy and Connally. Connally himself and his wife both testified before the commission that they saw Kennedy get hit by a separate bullet before Connally himself was struck. Oswald's records in shooting as a Marine compared favorably with the average U.S. citizen, but were not that high for a Marine. And by November 22, 1963, he had been away from the Marines for several years. His attempted but failed killing of Major General Walker, when Walker was quietly sitting down and not a moving target, makes one again question Oswald's skill as a sharpshooter. Although Oswald was only about 90 yards away from the presidential limousine, a reasonable distance for a skilled marksman, it was a moving target and had to be shot at an angle, all while under intense pressure. Further complicating the shot was that a traffic light pole and an oak tree temporarily obstructed the target at different points. While it might be reasonable to expect Oswald to hit his target once, expecting him to be able to hit his target 2 out of 3 times in 6 seconds under these circumstances seems very unlikely. Additionally, the FBI and U.S. Army had their best marksmen simulate Oswald's shot from the sixth floor of the TSBD using the rifle found at the scene. None of the marksmen could duplicate Oswald's supposed feat of hitting a moving target 2 times in 3 attempts in 6 seconds. Conspiracy motivation? If it is true that there was a group of conspiring men who wanted to have JFK killed and some of them were on the grassy knoll doing the shooting, what would be their motivation? There could be a number of things. 1. JFK wanted to do away with the Federal Reserve. He had actually passed an executive order to disband the Federal Reserve and to put our country back on the silver standard. It was called Executive Order 11110 and was signed on June 4, 1963. It returned to the U.S. government the power to issue currency without going through the Federal Reserve, as it used to be before the Fed was created in 1913. It gave back to the U.S. Treasurer the control over the currency. It also created $4 billion of currency backed by silver. After the death of JFK, When VP Lyndon Baines Johnson came into office as the new president, one of the first things he did was remove JFK's 11110 executive order. It became a rumor that no one in office can touch the Fed, because if you do, you'll end up like JFK. I wrote about the sneaky way in which the Fed came into being in 1913, and how powerful it is in a book that was published in 2010 called By Stealth and Deception. 2. JFK wanted to pull our troops out of the Vietnam War and bring them home. He instructed Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara to develop an appropriate withdrawal plan. Officially, Kennedy's policy for Vietnam centered on a tentative withdrawal of 1,000 U.S. military personnel by the end of 1963, and a complete withdrawal of all U.S. special assistance personnel by the end of 1965. This was totally contrary to the war hawks in the U.S. government, who wanted to escalate the war, and also the mighty international bankers who make so much money off the debt that nations go into as they fund their wars. There are also the powerful industries and corporations who make so much money selling their war equipment vehicles. This is all part of the military-industrial complex that President Ike Eisenhower warned us about. Sure enough, following Kennedy's assassination, when Lyndon B. Johnson took over as president, America's involvement in Vietnam escalated, shifting to a large-scale conflict by 1968 when nearly 550,000 American troops were involved. 3. JFK wanted to crack down on organized crime. The Kennedy family allegedly had many links to organized crime, starting with Joe Kennedy, Jack's father. In fact, it is believed that the mafia mob boss Sam Giancana was instrumental in Kennedy winning the presidential election. Giancana held considerable sway in Chicago politics, and rumors persist that he was instrumental in handing the crucial swing state of Illinois to Kennedy. However, the Kennedy administration soon alienated much of the mafia by cracking down on organized crime, spearheaded by the work of Kennedy's brother, Attorney General Bobby Kennedy. Bobby Kennedy sought to eliminate the mafia's influence over powerful labor unions, such as the Teamsters Union led by Jimmy Hoffa. Many mob bosses were infuriated by the supposed betrayal by John F. Kennedy, who they thought would turn a blind eye to most of their activities. There is much support for the view that the assassination of Kennedy was the work of the mafia, who felt threatened by the policies of Attorney General Bobby Kennedy. Frank Ragano, attorney of Jimmy Hoffa, claimed that mob boss Santos Trafficante admitted to him that he had played a role in Kennedy's assassination. The organized crime theory is relevant because nightclub owner Jack Ruby, who shot Lee Harvey Oswald 2 days later, also had ties to organized crime. For JFK adamantly opposed Israel's plan to develop nuclear weapons. His uncompromising posture enraged Israeli Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion and brought upon him the wrath of the Mossad, Israel's equivalent to the CIA. 5. There are other theories and possible motives, such as the theory that Vice President Johnson wanted JFK dead. Kennedy was too popular, and so was his brother Bobby. Johnson felt that JFK was grooming Bobby to be the president after him, but Johnson wanted that position, and so did the conspiring men behind him, so if JFK was killed, Johnson could take over without having to run for office and could then do all the socialist things that he was able to accomplish. It is thought that Kennedy did not have a good relationship with J. Edgar Hoover, head of the FBI, or Alan Dulles, head of the CIA, whom JFK fired. Maybe they could have also been involved in wanting him gone and out of the picture. Conclusion. I am grateful to Ruth Payne for her interview, which whet my curiosity to do more research and learn more. After my research, I am also of the opinion that there is much in the Warren Commission that is being kept hidden and in the many JFK files that are still not allowed to be open. Hopefully someday the total truth will be able to be revealed. Until that day, one can understand why conspiracy theories are flourishing and more people are beginning to believe that a very dark, deep state is running our nation and government.